Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome. Award-winning journalist Stephen Wynn is my second guest today. Best-selling author Amy Tan describes his new book as a delightful story about the joys and deeper meanings that dogs bring into our lives. But first, I'm talking with producer-director Michael Schwartz about his new film, The Botany of Desire. It's coming to PBS this month. And the film takes viewers from the potato fields of Peru and Idaho to the apple forests of Kazakhstan, and from the tulip markets of Amsterdam to the medical marijuana grow rooms of the U.S. It explores the human desires that link these plants' destinies to our own. Well, Michael Schwartz's resume is so impressive that I literally could fill the entire segment with his credits alone. But I will tell you that he's worked for many years in public television, first as an independent producer of character-driven films such as Abortion Clinic and Living Below the Line, then as part of the senior management team at PBS in San Francisco. His work has been honored with some of the most prestigious awards in broadcasting. 3 National Emmy Awards, 2 George Foster Peabody Awards, the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Journalism Award for Investigative Journalism, and numerous Cine Golden Eagles and local Emmys. Michael Schwartz's new film is based on Michael Pollan's book, The Botany of Desire. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations, first of all, I have to say, on making such a great film. For those who aren't familiar with Michael Pollan's book, I just wanted to give a little background on The Botany of Desire and how you became involved. Pollan's book began when he and his wife left New York City and moved to an old dairy farm. He was working in the garden one day and wondered, do plants use humans as much as we use them? Now, I know you guys have been friends for many years, collaborated on a lot of projects. What was it, other than the fact that he sent you the book, but what was it that drew you to this piece of work in particular enough to make a film about it?
Well, you know, I love the whole idea of looking at the world from the plant's point of view. I thought that was a very unusual approach to take to the subject, and I'd never really thought of the world that way. But when you do, it sort of causes you to rethink your whole relationship with nature itself, which we normally think of when we talk about having a relationship with nature. Even in using that language, we're suggesting that nature is something that's apart from us and separate from us. But when we look at things from the plant's point of view, the way that Michael does in the book and we do in the show, I think it causes, you know, I think it suggests that maybe we're a part of nature in a way that we hadn't really thought about before. Mm. So I thought that idea was a really interesting idea, but what particularly made me want to make the film was that I thought that the stories of each of these plants and the human desires that they exploit, as Michael told them in the book, are really compelling and provocative and engaging, and I thought they'd make great material for a show.
Now, this was the kind of film to me, all the way through, I kept going, wow, I did not know that. There were some amazing facts in here as well. I mean, you know, without lecturing at us, I just learned such a lot from this film. Do you know why he chose those 4 particular plants in the first place?
You know, I think he thought about a lot of different plants, but, you know, in the end, I think it's largely because the stories associated with each of them are so compelling, and precisely because there's so much about them that makes you think, wow, I didn't know that before.
That's true. My friend I watched it with said, this is existentialism at its best. Yeah. One of the hardest parts of making a film is raising the money, and I read that it took you 5 years to raise the funds for this project.
More than that.
And I read that you said one of the problems was that one of the plants was the marijuana plant, and it makes it hard to get funding for. Share a little bit about how you raised the funds for this and how you got around that situation. What kind of challenges came up?
Well, you know, we raised the money for it the way we always do, which is we write proposals and then we approach different organizations and we try to get their support. And in the case of this project, the fact that one of our main characters was the marijuana plant, and we were going out for funding at the turn of the century and the part of the 2000s. Made it tricky. There were a lot of organizations that were reluctant. But I should say that, the first funder we had was PBS, which gave us a small research and development grant, and that helped us get started. And then after a couple we had a couple of unsuccessful attempts, but eventually the National Science Foundation decided to support the project, and they really became the largest funder for production money. And then after many years passed, and we felt that we had really hit the wall because we couldn't get any corporate funders, and we weren't having much luck with foundations either, I think partly because what makes the book interesting is that it's deals with so many different, it looks at the plants through so many different lenses of, social history and environmentalism. There's science in it. But what makes it interesting is the book tends to make it difficult to fund because a lot of the organizations you go to want something that's very highly focused, that, say, just looks at sustainable agriculture or just looks at neuroscience. And because we did many of those different things, we didn't fall into, we weren't easily categorizable. So what happened is that after we ran into this wall, the National Science Foundation gave us permission to spend a little bit of its money to try to advance the, as they put it, to try to advance the interests of the project. And Michael and I talked, and we felt that the best way to do that would be to produce some of the marijuana content, because we kept on getting questions about how we were going to treat that subject and how we were going to tell that story. And it was a fear, I think, in many quarters that because we were telling the story of, the natural history of the plant and our relationship to it, that we might inadvertently somehow be promoting drug use.
Right.
We kept saying, no, we're not doing that. But,
right.
But no matter how often we said that or wrote that, it wasn't persuasive. So in the end, we thought the only way to try to address those concerns is to actually show people the material. And the National Science Foundation gave us permission, in effect, to do that. So we produced that content, and we sent it to PBS, and they liked it sufficiently that they came in as a major funder. Mm-hmm. So in the end, we had funding from the National Science Foundation, from PBS, from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation in New York, which funds a lot of programming about science and technology, and also from the Columbia Foundation in San Francisco.
You filmed this so beautifully as well. I think you had a couple of videographers work on it, as far as I remember. But you used a lot of macro photography, and especially when you were filming the tulips. And here was an interesting fact, because I just assumed, because Amsterdam has the huge tulip festival every year, and that's where one in three of all of our flowers come from. I always assumed that's where the tulip was originated, and it wasn't. It was originated in Asia.
Yeah, Central Asia. Just like the apple.
Yeah, yeah.
We try to. I had two very talented and quite brilliant cinematographers who worked on the film, and they helped to, I think, make it look as good as it does. Yeah, but we tried very hard to not only visualize the story from the plant's point of view, but also to use the tools at our disposal to photograph the plants and tell the story in a way that would make people see them as they perhaps hadn't seen them before. So macro photography is one way of doing that. One of the things, the camera can see things in a way that the human eye can't. And it's one of the fun parts of working in television is that you get to use these spectacular cameras that can really reveal the world in a whole new way.
Right.
We tried to do that. We also tried to take the plants out of their normal context. We actually tried to take them out of nature, because sometimes photographing them in nature is sometimes when you're looking at the plants in nature, there's so much else that can distract you that you don't get to see them in the way we wanted people to see them. So we did a bunch of photography where we actually removed them from their natural environment, and we we focus on them in a way you don't normally get to do. And that's a significant part of the show.
Yeah, I think one of the shots that was it was quite spectacular, really, was a shot of a growing room, the marijuana and the resin that forms on them.
Yeah.
And the more resin, apparently, the higher you get on that particular plant. But the photography on that was spectacular.
Yeah. No, it looked like some kind of fancy salad. When you see the bud that close up.
Be careful what you eat.
We've had some fun showing some of those images around, because if you don't know what it is, you can come up with a lot of different guesses.
Yeah.
You know, and most people would never guess it's actually a marijuana bud.
Right. You said that the most interesting thing about Michael Pollan's book to you is that it's about what's going on in his mind, that it allows you into his head and what he's thinking about the plants. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to ask you about that and how you transferred that, what was in his head, to film, because it's kind of hard to do.
Okay.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest this segment is Michael Schwartz. He's the producer and director of The Botany of Desire, coming to PBS this month. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Tiny bubbles.
Coming up November 2nd on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Vicky leads us vicariously to Hawaii, the metaphysical and the historical, with three novelists whose books are heading your way. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Check out conversationslive.net, where you can listen to dozens of fiction book reviews and featured past shows.
Well, the feeling that I'm going to love.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
The new mainstream of talk radio. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Michael Schwartz. He's the producer and director of The Botany of Desire. It's based on Michael Pollan's book, and it was a best-selling book, came out about 9 years ago, and it's taken all this while to put this great film together. And we're lucky enough to have four copies of the DVD to give away to listeners today. So I'm going to ask Eric to come in here in a second and just give us the number to call here. And don't be shy, you can get a copy of the DVD. It's a great film. It really is a great film. I learned so much from it. I know you haven't had a chance to watch it yet, Eric, but I'd highly recommend it.
Awesome.
So, and as I said, we've got four copies here to give away to listeners today. So what number can they call if they'd like a copy of this great film?
So first four callers will win a copy.
Okay.
All right. So
to our documentary DVD.
Give us a call at 425-373-5527. That's 425-373-5527. Or toll free in Western Washington at 888-298-KKNW. That's 888-298-5569. And again, the next four callers will win a copy of the Botany of Desire DVD.
And it's actually airing, phones are off going already. It's actually airing on PBS this coming Wednesday, correct, Michael?
That's right, at 8 o'clock.
At 8 o'clock. But this is the kind of film you want to watch more than once. I watched it twice, and I probably will watch it another couple of times. It's the kind of film that is just, it's so filled with information that just blew my mind, really. One of the things that surprised me, because I, you know, grew up in Europe and I've heard about the Tulip Festival of Amsterdam all this time, and I know how huge that is. But when I actually saw the market on the film, and you said it's 11 football, the size of 11 football fields, it was amazing.
Yeah, no, it's enormous. It's probably the biggest building I've ever been in. I think we actually say it's a 200. It's something, you know, unimaginable.
Yeah.
The floor of that building, but there are millions of flowers that pass through there every day. I think it's 1 in 3 flowers sold in the world pass through that market every day.
Yeah, I was just amazed. Just amazed. I said before the break that one of the things that you've said to you that is most interesting about Michael Pollan's book is the fact that you get right inside that man's head. And it's like reading his mind about what he's thinking, about what's going on. But it's in a very philosophical nature, and that would not have translated very well to film. So tell us a little bit about how you took that book and made it into such a visually stunning and informative film.
I have said that about the book, that the book is very much, it's very philosophical, and Michael does a lot of musing about the plants. It's very nonlinear. He flits around from one idea to another. All of which makes for a great read, but it's very difficult to translate. So when we started to think about how to turn this into a television program, we decided fairly early in the process that we didn't really want to make a movie about how much as I love Michael, about how Michael's mind works.
Right.
We decided we really needed to make the plants the main characters of our story. I'm sorry, there's a fire engine going by outside. But we decided we needed to make the plants the main characters of our story and to make it about the natural history of those plants. But, you know, then you run into a new problem, which is the plants don't walk. They don't talk and they don't move.
Right, right.
So, we have to think about, well, what can we do to keep this engaging for a television audience? And we thought that the answer to that question was really contained in the idea that Michael puts forward in the book, that it may be that the plants don't just work for us, but in fact we work for them. And so we began searching for characters who embodied that idea in their own lives. And I think one of the fun parts of the film is that each of the plants, each of the stories of the plants is driven in many ways by a character who, in some sense, is mad about that plant and just obsessed by it and has, you know, quite literally devoted his or her life to it. So, you know, it becomes in many ways a relationship story, and we work throughout the film to suggest that not only in the narrative, but also in the way we sort of show the story visually. We constantly have people, you know, there's a lot of shooting of plants in the foreground and people in the background, so that you get the visual sense of the mm-hmm. connection we have with these plants and how we work for them.
Mm. One of the issues you looked at, a big, big issue, is biotechnology, genetically altered food, manufactured food. We've actually done a show on that before, but I find it's very hard to get a clear picture on what's really happening with that, because people seem to be at one end of the spectrum. They're either, you know, really very much for it or very much against it. Having worked on this film and done the kind of research that you've done, where do you stand on that, and what can you tell us from your perspective about genetically modified food?
Well, first, there's a lot of it.
Much more than we think, right?
The potato story that we tell is really the exception to the rule in some ways, because, you know, in the end, there's a potato that's featured in the film called the New Leaf Potato, which was introduced into the market by Monsanto, and it contains, it's genetically engineered to be able to kill the Colorado potato beetle, which is one of the russet Burbank potatoes' worst enemies. And it actually did that quite effectively, but because of the fears about genetic engineering that existed a few years ago when Monsanto introduced the potato, some of the organizations that were buying potatoes essentially said that they didn't want genetically engineered potatoes, and Monsanto wound up withdrawing the potato from the market. But it's actually had a lot of success with other genetically engineered crops. I think the vast majority of the soy crop in this country is now genetically modified. And there's a lot of other genetically modified foods around. But I think what I hope we suggest through the film is that the story of genetic engineering is a complicated story. The farmers, some of the big farmers who we show in the film, would rather use genetically engineered potatoes than... I mean, let me back up a little bit. The reason that genetically modified crops are popular among farmers is that they enable the farmers to avoid spraying certain pesticides. And the reason the farmers need to spray the pesticides is that they're growing large amounts of a single crop. And when you do that, I think one of the big underlying themes of the film has to do with the trade-offs between monoculture and biodiversity, that as we, as eaters of food, as we demand more and more of single kinds of food, like the russet Burbank potato, which is used for French fries in much of the country, the more we grow single crops, the more vulnerable those crops become to certain kinds of pests or diseases. In order to protect the crops from those pests or diseases, farmers need to come up with ways of fighting them, and those tend to be, at the moment, either pesticides or genetic engineering. So some of the farmers would much rather use genetically engineered crops than have to spray as much pesticide as they do right now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other side of that story is that there are other ways to grow crops, and if you grow a variety of crops or use certain kinds of crop rotation methods or natural disease fighters, you can possibly avoid both pesticides and genetically modified crops.
Mm. And Michael Pollan talks a lot about monocultures and says that's one of the key takeaways from this whole adventure for him is that we need to diversify and get away from the monoculture of just growing. Well, for example, the russet potato is grown or bought by McDonald's for their particular French fries, right?
Not just McDonald's.
McDonald's. Yeah, I mean, it's a very popular.
Yeah, it's very popular potato for French fries because it's long and it can be cut up into nice long French fries and it tends to be consumers' favorite kind of French fry. Other kinds of potatoes, if you think of what you see in the market, they're small and round and they don't lend themselves nearly as well to being manufactured into French fries.
Yeah. I liked this line in the film where you were interviewing Michael Pollan, and I'm going to quote, he adds that he talks about the order that we impose on nature is never more than temporary or illusionary. And we cast evolutionary votes in everything we do, from what we choose to eat to what flowers to put on our tables and what drugs we choose to take. What are some of your key takeaways from working on this project?
Well, it's hard to say it better than Michael said it there, I think.
Well, you may have had a whole different takeaway.
I think the film is about the way we've evolved with these plants, that we act on us just as they act on them, and that all these choices we make do have an impact. I think the biggest choices we make tend to be in what we eat. We can have a bigger impact on the natural world through our choices about what to eat than almost anything we do. I think Michael has, become well known for saying these days that, if you gave up meat, for instance, or even if you cut back on it, if there was a meatless Monday, I forget the number of, it would be the equivalent of taking a huge number of cars off the road.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
I think those are the sorts of things we get out of the film.
He said that the film completely exceeded his expectations. That's pretty high accolades there from an author, because they're rarely satisfied with a film that's been made based on their book. As a filmmaker, how do you? That must make you feel good, right?
Oh, sure, it does. I mean, not only as a filmmaker, but also as an old friend of mine, because there was a, you know, we felt a big responsibility toward the book and to him, and it was a challenge to translate. You know, I'm thrilled that he's happy with it. Mm. He gives me a lot of grief, though, because we didn't include Dionysus and Apollo, who were big figures in the book, but...
Hard to interview, right?
And I said, but we gave you Swedenborg. There's a nice, interesting section about Swedenborg and his religious philosophy. That's part of the Johnny Appleseed story. And, you know, I think, you know, I tell him that Dionysus wouldn't agree to an interview.
Yeah, pretty difficult there. You don't have those kind of powers, right? So you went all over the place for this. You went to Peru, Kazakhstan, Amsterdam. Did you? What surprised you the most on your journey as a filmmaker?
Well, you know, we did go to a lot of different places, and I think, gosh, what surprised me the most? I suppose what surprised me the most is the lengths to which people will go in their devotion for a particular plant, and those surprises those surprises kept happening everywhere we were, whether it was in Holland. You know, we met a tulip breeder named Jan Ligthart, who's a big strapping guy about 6'2" tall. You know, and a guy who spent his life in the fields and, you know, strong as an ox. And there's a wonderful scene, one of my favorites in the movie, where he tells us why he's completely fallen in love with pink tulip, and it makes his heart go all aflutter. You know, or we have a marijuana grower in a grow room who is completely obsessed with his plants. He's got a whole computerized operation to make sure they're well tended and cared for, and who feels like he can't go away for more than a couple of days or the plants will suffer.
Yeah.
I think that's also true when you go to Peru and you see the farmers in the Altiplano in the Andes of Peru, who, you know, you dig up a field of about 100 square feet. There's as many different kinds of potatoes there. You know, there's about 100 different kinds of potatoes that's in a 100 square foot plot. And it's extraordinary the lengths to which people will go to grow all of these plants.
A lot of really dedicated people. And I could understand why he was in love with that pink tulip, because I loved it too.
Yeah, it's a great-looking tulip. Maybe it'll come to market. I mean, it takes a generation to breed most of these tulips. And, you know, I think he's been working on this particular tulip now for almost 10 years, and I don't think it's come to market yet, but it will soon.
Yeah. And a little interesting fact that was in the film there on tulips was that the ones that have the flame color going through, which we find so attractive, are actually caused by a virus. And way back when, I can't remember which king it was, but they paid an extraordinary amount of money for that. And I think in the film it said it would have been the equivalent of like $10 to $15 million today for that.
Right, the price of a townhouse in New York on Central Park.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Michael. What do you hope listeners take away from this when they see the film?
Well, I hope they'll have fun watching it. I think there's a lot of wit and humor in it, and I've seen it now with audiences twice. We had screenings in San Francisco and New York, and my favorite part is when you can just hear people sort of drawing in their breath at the sight of some of the images that we put on screen, because they really are spectacular, and these plants are extraordinarily beautiful, and their stories are amazing, and you know, our main hope is that people enjoy it and tell their friends about it, and on Wednesday night that they watch this show instead of the World Series.
There you go. Watch Michael Schwartz's film instead of the World Series. And it's going to be on PBS on Wednesday, October 28th at 8 p.m., correct?
That's right.
Yep. Well, I thank you so much for being with us today. Again, if listeners, you want to find out more about the film, the upcoming film, just go to pbs.org, pbs.org/The Botany of Desire. And there's a whole ton of information up there. It's really interesting.
And I think the website will also give you, a number of broadcasts. Many stations are running the show more than once, so the website has a tool that shows you all the times and dates at which the program will be broadcast in your community.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael Schwartz, for being with us. I'm going to look out for your next film when that comes out.
Well, thank you very much for the time and for all your good questions.
Thank you. And please stay with us. We'll be right back with Stephen Wynn. His new book is called Come Back, Como. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk podcast reviews brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk podcasts today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Radio for your body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk, 1150.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My second guest today is award-winning journalist and fiction writer Stephen Wynn. He spent many years as a staff writer at the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's a former Wallace Stegner Fellow in Fiction at Stanford University. He's also a founding staff member of The Great Seattle Weekly. He's written for publications from Good Housekeeping, Parenting, and Parents to Sports Illustrated, the AARP magazine, the Utney Reader, and National Lampoon. And he's appeared on 2020, Today, NBC Nightly News, A&E Biography, and NPR. And he's joining us today to talk about his new book, Come Back Como, Winning the Heart of a Reluctant Dog. Stephen Wynn, welcome.
Great to be here, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Well, I mentioned in your intro there that you were one of the founding members of Seattle Weekly. So obviously you were up here at some point in your career, in your life.
I was indeed. Spent 6 wonderful years in Seattle. And so long ago, in fact, that the first story we covered for Seattle Weekly was the opening of the kingdom, now long gone. So I'm afraid that dates me terribly.
I didn't realize the Seattle Weekly had been around that long, to be honest.
Indeed. So, yes, that was back in the mid-70s, 75.
Wow. And so let's talk about your new book. It's called Come Back Como, Winning the Heart of a Reluctant Dog. This is such a fun book.
Thanks so much.
And I know that dog lovers would enjoy it, but on the back of the book, there was somebody there who confessed that he didn't even like animals, and he still enjoyed it.
After dealing with Como, I have some ambivalence about dogs myself, as a matter of fact, especially this one.
Yeah. So he, for years, your only child begged you. She begged you for a dog, and for years, you and your wife, Sally, fobbed her off with repeated viewings, in your own words, of 101 Dalmatians and a stuffed husky dog. Now, come on, Stephen.
I know. We were dreadful parents, weren't we? Well, then we did go up the food chain a little bit. We went to live things like goldfish, which we seemed to kill off with remarkable rapidity, and an ill-fated lovebird, who also met an untimely end. And the other thing we did is we basically borrowed our neighbor's dogs and tried to fob them off on Phoebe, but she was having none of it. She was determined to have a dog.
So why were you so against getting a dog in the first place?
Well, both Sally and I had less than ideal relationships with dogs when we were children. We'd each had a childhood dog who was her. Sally's dog was a purebred poodle named Pierre LaPierre Beauregard, and he he was sort of nasty and violent and bit everybody in their family. And we had a dachshund who was arbitrarily violent, who would, under seemingly most benign circumstances, would lunge at someone and bite and hang on neighbors, the little girl next door. So neither one of us had great dog experiences. And also, I think we were just sort of selfish. We thought, well, you know, it's going to restrict our ability to travel, and who's going to feed him and walk him in the rain and all of those things that people sort of, reasons they cite to resist or delay getting a dog. So those were some of the factors, but Phoebe was just determined.
Mm. Well, there is a lot to consider when you get a dog, that's for sure. And especially, I was watching TV the other day, and they're starting to run adverts about don't buy a puppy for Christmas unless you can really, take care of it. But what made you cave in eventually and get your daughter Phoebe this wonderful dog that you wrote this book about?
He didn't seem so wonderful at the time, I have to say.
Well, I know.
We'd actually been to this shelter in Redwood City, about 25 miles south of where we live in San Francisco, and seen what I thought was the ideal dog, whose principal virtue was that she basically didn't move. She breathed and wagged her tail a little bit. She was largely inert. I thought, that's perfect. She'll just sit in the middle of the floor and look dog-like, and there'll be no problems with her. Phoebe wanted no part of that dog. But we did end up returning to that shelter several weeks later, and found this dog, who was named Gandalf at the time, who was the most unpromising dog we'd seen. He looked sort of like a dust mop or something. He was absolutely filthy, kind of rodent-like, right. Was either cowering at the back of his cage or leaping straight up at the fence in front of us. And Phoebe saw something that I certainly didn't. So that was to be her dog, she determined. And what we learned on the way out of the shelter after the deal had already been struck was that, one, he'd already been adopted once in return, which they were sort of reluctant to let us know, and two, that apparently he'd had issues with men somewhere along the line and didn't really care for my gender. Me being the only male in the house, I received the brunt of his dislike. So we got off to a very rough start, to put it mildly.
Right. And the book is about your trials and tribulations, but and about the lessons you learned along the way. And yes, we've established he was a man hater. He was also a cage hater, and he was a Stephen Wynn hater. But you did eventually win him over, right? I would you agree on that?
Well, yes, I would agree with some provisions. I mean, he still... It much prefers my wife and daughter to me. when they come in the front door, it's a joyful reunion. When I walk up the steps and he's in another room of the house, he mostly doesn't stir. So I've learned humility, among other things. But yes, I mean, we have reached a truce, but not without many, many trials and tribulations, including many that occurred after we'd gone through the initial adjustment phase, when he chewed his way out of the cage and made multiple escapes from the house. So the difficulties continued for quite a while and haven't fully been resolved.
I love the prologue to the book where you are describing how he's escaped. He's also an escape artist, we should let listeners know.
A world-class escape artist.
Yeah, world-class escape artist. And you're running through the streets of San Francisco and he will not come. And of course, when you chase a dog, what do? They run away more.
Especially when I'm the one pursuing.
So you have this brilliant idea of laying on the floor and becoming dog-like.
Well, laying on the ground in the middle of 11th Avenue in our neighborhood, which worked great for a while, and I thought his curiosity or his perversity or something got him to come very close to me, close enough that we were sort of eye to eye with each other. I was just about to grab him when a gardening truck clattered across the next intersection, spooked him, scared him off again, and away we get. The chase continued. And it was really only through the ministrations of a good Samaritan who appeared out of nowhere, flung open his car door and said, "Get in to me," drove up ahead of the dog, sort of circled him, handed me a power bar, which he was eating, and we used that as a lure and got him. I would not have caught him that time, to be sure.
He was such a damaged dog. As you said, he'd been in two different shelters that you knew of. He'd been adopted at least once and returned at least once that you knew of.
Exactly.
My dog actually is a shelter dog, too, and I'm his fifth owner.
my goodness. But, a lot of mileage on that dog.
But you know what? He's the best dog I've ever had.
Yeah, it's
he's incredible.
I think dogs who have been in shelters, I mean, this is, again, because they can't tell us. We can only, posit things about what experience they've been through or guess or try to speculate. But I do think that dogs who have been in shelters have often had rough times of one kind or another, and they've had to learn to live by their wits, and they've become very sensitive to their environments, maybe more so than dogs who are, raised in the lap of luxury from puppydom on, that they've had to they've learned about humans and how to survive and how to handle and respond to them. Como is extraordinarily sensitive to the slightest little nuance in behavior, favorable or negative.
Mm.
And I think a lot of shelter dogs are like that. Other people have told me that, and I've seen that they've just had to learn more about getting along with people. And consequently, they have a quality that other dogs, I think, maybe don't necessarily.
Yeah, I remember when I adopted mine, which was 2 years ago, and he's a border collie. So, I know they can be, they need a lot of attention. They need to be kept busy. They're working dogs.
They need to run.
Yeah, they need to run. He needs to run. But I know the first few weeks I had him, I thought he was depressed because he kept looking out of one eye at me very suspiciously. And I think he was wondering when I was going to take him back to the pound.
Well, yes. I mean, there's no question that our dog had been traumatized in some way. Como had been traumatized. We don't know what. There's a spot on his left flank, sort of near his back leg, where the fur has sort of been, something happened there. The fur doesn't grow on this one spot, and it would appear, was he burned? Was he, something happened there. We actually, the shelter sort of didn't reveal that to us. We called them later and said, "What do you think this might be?" And they didn't really know, but something. I learned that something must have happened with the man who wore black shoes. I had bought a pair of black shoes, and the first time I put them on, this is after we'd had the dog for a long time, we'd made progress, and he just freaked when I wore these shoes.
Mm.
And it was my wife who figured it out. She said, "Aren't those new shoes?" And I said, "Yes." So that was a $140 pair of shoes which got worn once around the dog.
He'd probably been booted with something like that,
yeah.
So, but what was it in you that made you want to get past all of his neuroses and bring him into the family?
Well, it really
or keep
was,
him in I mean, the family.
it really was about the family, and part of what the book is about is the dog and my relationship with the dog, but it's also really about us as a family. And we got Como when Phoebe was 12 years old, and she just left for college 2 months ago. So it was really about the way this dog became part of our family is really about what happened to us as our only child grew up, and watching her be both responsible and loving and caring was exciting and thrilling for all of us, and it really was a bonding thing, especially because we went through such trials with the dog, including him on one of his more notable escapes, which did not end well when he, the only way he had out from, as I was pursuing him from one direction and strangers were pursuing him from the other, his only escape route was out into a street where he was run over by an SUV, nearly died. And going through that with our daughter and Sally and I, it was a very rich, powerful experience in many ways. And while we certainly wouldn't have chosen that, I wouldn't give that up for anything. I think it really changed and deepened us as a family.
Yeah. You said it even improved your marriage because you had these meandering conversations that you probably wouldn't have had without without Como in the family.
Including several when Sally who was really great about the dog all along, except when she gets into bed at night and the lights go out, her demons are sort of set loose. And there was one night, which I do write about in the book, when we speculated pretty much jokingly, but maybe not tiringly, that perhaps there was a way we could do the dog in and escape from our oppression, because he was really quite difficult to handle at the beginning. He was really amazingly determined dog. I mean, the first night we had him in a heavy hinged plastic crate, and he chewed his way through those plastic hinges.
Oh,
we took the crate back to the pet store saying, could this have been defective? And they sort of took a step back and said, what sort of animal did you have in there? I think they thought we had some kind of a genetic mutant, monster of some kind. They really couldn't believe he had done that.
Yeah.
So he was very determined, and confinement is not his thing at all.
Now, he did have an accident, as you mentioned, and he had surgery. Was that the turning point for you, really, with him?
Well, I think it was. I mean, the way that it happened, we were having work done on our house, which meant that there were a lot of noisy, boisterous, loud-mouthed men in the house, not his favorite gender again. There were three or four of them. And they had the front door off the hinges as they were demoing stuff and carrying it out to the front. And we had him confined in the back of the house. But one of the workmen left the door open just wide enough for him to slip through. And this happened first thing in the morning. I was wearing my bathrobe and nothing else. And so the pursuit occurred with me in a state. And out he went, and I was the one who was pursuing him, and I was the last one who was going to be able to catch him. No good Samaritan materialized this time. I tried to circle around. He set off in the same direction. I circled around, thought, well, I'll chase him back towards the house. Well, he came back towards the house, took a left turn down the hill, and a block down was when this happened. And I did feel a sense of my own absurdity. I also felt, and it just overwhelmed me when the dog was hit and lay what I thought was surely dead or dying in the street, this enormous, welling up of feeling for the dog and for us and for what I had lost, and it was my responsibility, and how heartbroken my daughter was going to be and my wife and all of us. It was just, I was so beside myself that when I finally, the dog was still breathing very quickly, very rapid breathing, when I picked him up, I turned, but there were people out in the street, trying to comfort me as much as the dog, I think. I picked him up and turned to some woman and said, here, take me to the vet. Got into her car, and it was only then that I realized she was the woman who had actually hit him.
Oh.
And she felt terrible.
Right.
It was not her fault. The dog ran straight out in front of her car. And she had her son, a young child, in the back seat, who was asking, what's wrong with the dog, Mom? Where are we going? And it was just, when something like that happens, your ability to take in different layers of it. I mean, I saw the absurdity of it. I felt the pain of it. I saw the sort of bittersweet quality of this poor, innocent kid who wanted to know what had happened. And the woman next to me who hit him and felt so guilty. I mean, all of those things were just churning away. And the dog had bit me, not out of anger or anything, but just out of reflex when I went out to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was bleeding and didn't realize it. When we got into the vet's office, there I was in my bathroom with my hair uncombed, and the dog was back being stabilized, and I was charging around this becalmed vet office, sprinkling my blood all over the place and wondering why the place was so ill cared for, not realizing it was me.
It was you.
So I was to say that I, but yes, it was definitely a, was one of those terrible but weirdly peak experiences when your senses are heightened and you're, I did not realize how much I loved this dog and how much I valued him and how important he was to all of us. And, you know, the sense of terror and guilt and fear about what lay ahead for him was just really overwhelming.
Mm.
That we got through it was, miraculous. And I think it did change us. And he also, I suppose at one point I thought, well, he's going to blame me for this. And he didn't seem to. I mean, he didn't seem to hold me accountable. Dogs take in experience differently than we do.
Yeah.
And he didn't seem to. So in an odd way, it seemed to, maybe we went through something together and he sort of sensed that and we gradually became closer, I think.
I think there is a bonding there with animals because years ago I had a horse who almost died and I spent the night in the stable with him and he used to bite me at every opportunity. Mm. But after I'd spent the night with him in the stable and he got well again, he never bit me again.
Yes, I mean, things do happen that way. They're remarkably attuned to us, domesticated animals, and it's just, it's a very powerful bond. One of the things I write about in the book is my father's relationship with our family dog, that sort of nasty dachshund. My father just adored unreservedly. And when that dog died unexpectedly, my father sobbed. My father was not a man of overt, expressive qualities, but he sobbed for 4 days. And it was really, that dog opened up some place in him that other people. I mean, I think the dog was just because dogs can't talk back or disappoint us in certain ways, they can often open up reservoirs of love and affection and bonding, as you say, that don't always happen with people even.
Yeah, it's very true. You say one of the lessons you learned, Steve, you talked a little bit about how family dynamics changed, but another lesson was how gender works. What was it that taught you more about gender and how gender works?
Well, I suppose I thought, as a man, I suppose I thought I could sort of, triumph just by perseverance and force of will. And that's not how animals work. I mean, watching how sensitively both Phoebe and Sally dealt with the dog and how much affection they would, how they would spend just long hours with him just in their laps. And I sort of thought, well, I'll spend a little bit of quality time and then we'll be great. And that's just not how dogs work. And it's not really how life and feelings work. But sometimes I think men are a little inclined to think that they can master it just by force of will and intention and intellect. And that doesn't work necessarily.
Yeah.
And of course, in knowing that a dog really, had an experience with a man or men and had kind of generalized that to a certain extent was also humbling, that I'm part of I'm a member of my gender and the dog had certain feelings about that gender and that was humbling.
Mm. Well, it sounds as though he certainly changed you, this dog you call Como, who once was called Gandalf, right?
Yes, that's right.
But what do you hope, when people read this, they take away from the book?
Well, I mean, it's funny, a lot of what happened to us, and I hope people, enjoy that and enjoy sort of living through our mishaps with this dog. But I also hope that people will maybe reflect on their own experience with animals. And beyond that, as you said, someone who blurbed the book talked about, you don't necessarily have to be an animal person to appreciate it, that it really is about families and about love and comedy and misadventure and being resilient and rolling with the punches. And it's just a story about, what happens to a family when an alien comes to live with them.
But that alien now is somewhat substituting for your daughter who's growing up and moving on, right?
Very, very much so. I mean, dogs can be depressed, as you mentioned. I mean, when Phoebe went off to college, he spends most of the night now on the end of her bed. I mean, he definitely misses her, and he was definitely morose a bit and certainly registers her absence. They're very sensitive, and he knows she's gone.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you being with us today. It's a funny book. There are some good lessons in there, good stories in there. people can reach you at comebackcomo.com. That's correct, isn't it? Correct.
That's right. Comebackcomo.com is the website. I also wanted to say I will be in Seattle doing a reading on December 2nd at Elliott Bay at 7 o'clock.
December 2nd. Well, if you drop me an email, I'll remind our listeners closer to that
date. I will do that for sure.
Yeah, December 2nd. All right, and you can find out more information at comebackcomo.com. And the name of the book, again, is Come Back Como, Winning the Heart of a Reluctant Dog. And my guest, Stephen Wynn. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us
today. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. And I also want to just remind you that Michael Schwartz, my first guest, his film will be airing on PBS on Wednesday, the 28th at 8 p.m. You can find out more about that either by going to our website at conversationslive.net and looking at today's show, or by going to pbs.org/The Botany of Desire. I want to thank you for being with us today. We're going to mail out the DVDs to the people who called in. We've got four giveaways, and we'll get those out to you tomorrow. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Tiny bubbles.
Coming up November 2nd on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Vicki leads us vicariously to Hawaii, the metaphysical and the historical, with three novelists whose books are heading your way. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Check out conversationslive.net, where you can listen to dozens of fiction book reviews and featured past shows.
Views expressed on the preceding